Good morning. Happy Earth Day. And the rumors are true, it's also my birthday. My name is Jessica, thank you. My name is Jessica Sievers, and I'm a fellowship member, and I also serve on the board as chair-elect. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We invite our visitors and guests to sign our guest book at the welcome table just inside the front doors. On that form, you can request a complimentary subscription for our newsletter. Please, everyone, join us after the service for a short break to grab some coffee before we gather for our annual meeting back here in this sanctuary at 12:15. I would like to draw your attention to the other announcements printed in your order of service. Please know that all of our events are open to members and guests and friends and family alike. There's usually some contact information listed if you have any questions about any of the activities. This month, we are exploring the theme of emergence. I thought it was appropriate for Emergence and Earth Day to share an opening words from Maya Angelou called On the Pulse of Morning. And Lauren and Carrie are going to help light the chalice. A rock, a river, a tree, host to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. Any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today, the rock cries out to us, clearly, forcefully, come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny. But seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no more hiding place down here. You, created only a little lower than the angels, have crouched too long in the bruising darkness, have lain too long, face down in ignorance, your mouth spilling words, armed for slaughter. The rock cries out today, you may stand upon me, but do not hide your face. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. Come, rest here by my side, each of you a bordered country, delicate and strangely made proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege. Your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today I call you to my riverside, if you will study war no more. Come, clad in peace, and I will sing these songs the Creator gave to me when I and the tree and the stone were one. Before cynicism was a bloody sear across your brow, when you still knew nothing, the river sings and sings on. There is a true yearning to respond to the singing river and the wise rock. Say to the Asian, the Jew, the Hispanic, the African and Native American, the Sioux, the Catholic, Muslim, French, Greek, the Irish, the rabbi, the priest, the sheik, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher. They hear, they all hear, the speaking of the tree. Today, the first and the last of every tree speaks to humankind. Come to me here beside the river. Plant yourself beside me here beside the river. Each of you, descendant of some passed on traveler, has been paid for. You who gave me my first name, you Pawnee, Apache, and Seneca, you Cherokee Nation who rested with me, then forced on bloody feet, left me to the employment of other seekers, desperate for gain, starving for gold. You, the Turk, the Swede, the German, the Scot, you, the Ashanti, the Yoruba, the Crew, bought, sold, stolen, arriving on a nightmare, praying for a dream. Here, root yourselves beside me. I am the tree planted by the river, which will not be moved. I, the rock, the river, I, the tree, I am yours, Your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning on you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon the day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take into the palm of your hands, mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here, on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out upon me. The rock, the river, the tree, your country. No less to Midas than the mendicant, no less to you now than the mastodon then. Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes, into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope. Good morning. Next, we're going to have special music by our very own Dick Beeman, adapted and performed from a song called The Little Blue Ball. Your chorus lyrics are printed in your order of service. He would like for you to join in with him.
Yes, please join me in the chorus, which goes like this. We're living on a little green speck, on a little blue ball, in a big black sky, all alone. And we know we gotta take good care of that little blue ball, our womb, our world, our earth, our heaven, our when you see the Big Dipper in the northern sky, do you wonder why he dips all night? He's dipping out wisdom, dipping out love, dipping out a way of life. And when you see the gentle sparkle of that beautiful dipper, you'll notice other stars as well. And if you look around to where their light comes down, you'll understand the story they tell. That we're living on a little green speck, on a little blue ball, in a big black sky, all alone. And we know we gotta take good care of that little blue ball, our womb, our world, our earth, our heaven, our home. Did you ever hear a little spring peeper frog and wonder why he's trilling his fife? He's happy that he's made it through another winter. He's a herald of emerging life. And if we take good care of the things we share, the forest and the water and sky, we'll preserve what's here for all future years. And that peeper, he's telling us why. Because we're living on a little green speck, on a little blue ball, in a big black sky, all alone. And we know we gotta take good care of that little blue ball, our womb, our world, our earth, our heaven, our home. You see a little prairie flower waving in the wind, so lovely and so happy and bright. She's smiling just because she's the blossom of love in a world that's made just right. And every little flower petal glistening in the sun is a work of art, you see. But if we mow them all down and tear up the ground, we're not living like we ought to be. Because we're living on a little green speck, on a little blue ball, in a big black sky, all alone. And you know we gotta take good care of that little blue ball, our womb, our world, our earth, our heaven, our home. Yes, we know we gotta take good care of that little blue ball, our womb, our world, our earth, our heaven, our home.
Thank you for sharing with us, Dick. Our next performers are Rob DeLong, who wrote an original song called Redbird. Renee Reisner is accompanying on piano, Jeff Brown on bass, and Justin Trowbridge on percussion.
This is a song called Redbird, and it's a story about my wife's grandmother and grandfather. When he passed a number of years ago, oh, they'd been married for a long time, but they lived way out on Cape Cod, and long story short, it took us a couple of days to get up there to be with her, and when we got there, she told a story about a cardinal that was outside her window, kitchen window, that sort of stayed with her for a couple of days. Every time she'd look, he was out there singing. And so before we get started, I just want to thank Renee and Justin and Jeff. This is kind of, I've always wanted to do this song with a band, and it's, you know, super fun putting this together with them. So thank you guys so much. Redbird outside my window. This morning, watching me as if to say, what do you believe? Do you believe in hope? You can't hold hope in your hands. I believe pain train, it's coming for you one day soon. Oh, that's true. Pain train, it's coming for you. But you got a letter on. Got a feeling, yeah. You got a letter on through, 'cause it's good for you. Can't hold love in your
sings.
Let's have the children come forward for Story for All Ages. Go ahead and sit up here, and we'll be looking up at the wall for a special PowerPoint presentation. Video first. So that's pretty cool, don't you think? Who can tell me some of the stages of a caterpillar to a butterfly? Just shout them out.
Yes.
Yes, a chrysalis, yes.
Shout them out.
Larva. Egg. Butterfly. Do we have, sometimes it's called a pupa, sometimes it's called a larva. Yes.
A cocoon.
Yes. Caterpillars. Yes. So there's all these stages, right? And one thing that's really cool is nature does these really amazing things, taking one thing and then turning it into something else. And so you just watched this video about this caterpillar that grew into this beautiful pupa form, and then it transformed, and then it became this totally different thing. It got transformed. It was metamorphosis, is that cycle, right? So I wanted to share with you, since today's Earth Day, I was thinking about bringing something like my tub of recyclables to just show you how easy it is, and everybody can do it. And I think some of you have heard that song about how the recycling is taking over the corner. My poor boyfriend can attest to that. It's ridiculous. So let's take it up a notch, and let's look here at this photo. What do you see? Yes. Lots of wood. And does it look like it's like unused? It's not important. It might be trash. Like, I wonder what they're going to do with it. Maybe they'll just throw it away, or they'll burn it, or they'll leave it scattered around. No, they're going to make something with this. This is like recycling in art. So these people have taken all of this old wood from old structures, old buildings, and they decided they're going to build something with it. Any guesses here yet as to what this is going to be? Maybe a house, yes. Maybe a pyramid. Those are good ideas. So let's keep watching. What's that look like? It kind of looks like a hand. Like, oh my gosh, what are they doing? That one kind of looks like a foot. So it gets more and more interesting here. That up in the corner kind of looks like a big, big, giant face. And it's got this maybe arm or appendage. And it kind of looks like a troll. And it's got like trees growing up out of the hair. You can see it's got this really awesome face with all these geometric features. And this is all from recycled wood. And then they went and harvested plants from out in the forest. And they've made it so that his hair keeps growing, and it stays green all year round. And it's a swing at a park shaped like a giant troll. I thought that was really cool. So it turns out this guy has like two other troll buddies at this park that do other things. So there's other ways you can recycle. This is taking chicken egg shells and making it back into a chicken. This is a whole bunch of junk, a whole bunch of metal, and they made it into an elephant.
It looks like a hamburger.
What do you think this is made out of?
Fabric.
It's clothes, recycled clothes. And they've made this really cool bonsai tree. Anybody know who those guys are?
The Beatles,
out of an old cassette tape. I don't even know if these guys know what that is anymore. You got a lot of them laying around, so let's make them into something cool. So Beatles. And we're back to butterflies. And it's made out of plastic bottles. So take something old, discarded, unused, reduce, reuse, recycle into art. Pretty cool, huh? All right, let's sing you off to your classes. Many, many, many years before I was born, there was a group of people who united together and hatched a plan for what we know today as our beautiful butterfly of this fellowship. It hasn't always looked like this. Our UU started small in size, small in numbers. We met in rented spaces outside of, in Manhattan. But those few small groups of people, they were driven. They had a hunger for social justice, and they were fed by the spirit of community. And as their dreams grew, their vision for the larger community grew, and they incubated, and they metamorphosized. And I came to this fellowship, a simple adolescent teenager. And I was nurtured by your conversations. And I drank from the coffee. And I began to grow. And I began to grow into a new skin. And you shared with me your vision for the larger community. And I began to give my time to the UU, and you gave me a stronger foundation. Close to rainbow colored as I could get. And that foundation was based on the UU values. And you sent me to leadership school. And there I was transformed. And I metamorphosized into who I am today. And I began to give my talents to the UU. And today I give my treasures to the UU. And I ask that you consider contributing to the continuation of this cycle by sharing your time, your talents, and your treasures. Thank you.
Jessica just gave us a little sense of what emerges in our congregation, from our congregation, and with our congregation. We are continually an emerging community, and part of what emerges within us and beyond us is our connections with one another. And that's what we convey in the joys and concerns that come into our hearts and minds each week. I would note that I noticed in the paper this week that a former member of our congregation, Alicia Ofheim, passed away this week. And we keep that in our hearts because who we have been is part of who we are. Michael Oldfather tells us that the surgeon gave him a cleanish report last week, which we rejoice in. We also rejoice in the day we shared yesterday with him and members of his family as we celebrated his time here as our music director. We are forever appreciative of all he has given us. And finally, we remember all our members and those who struggle to be here sometimes, and in that, Judy Cattell reminds us that the Meadowlark Road is being repaired, so call if you need to come make a visit, and we encourage you to make such visits. That's what makes the bonds among us so deep and strong. And so I invite you to remember all of these things and to recognize that we all carry things in our hearts that are unspoken, and that we continue to be kind to one another as we emerge in community.
This is an excerpt from a foreword by John Burens to the book At Home in Creativity by Bruce Southworth. Take the need to simply feel at home in this world. It is a primary spiritual and moral need. Some otherworldly approaches to religion may suggest that our true home is elsewhere. But prophetic and pragmatic religion argues otherwise. It insists, in the words of feminist theologian Nell Morton, that the journey is home. William Sloane Cawthon puts it this way: the chief religious question can no longer be, what am I going to do to be saved? It must be, what are we all going to do together to save God's creation? All proposed solutions are perspectival, yet underlying them all is an undeniable reality. There is a unity in which all 5.5 billion of us now on this planet are all involved, a unity universal and eternal. It is not a unity that we humans are called on to create. No, it is given. The religious and the reflective task is to become more aware of this reality, then to embrace it more gratefully and make it the most manifest in choices we make and lives we lead, no matter how we name that unity, or choose not to name it at all. Please rise in body or spirit and join me in singing from the Gray Hymnal, hymn 295, Sing Out Praises for This Journey.
Thank you.
Another Earth Day. How many of you were here last week? Okay. Jim Scott offered us some beautiful songs. His message, though, left me a little depressed as he outlined the severity of environmental crises before us. I say crises rather than crisis deliberately because I could offer you a laundry list of the problems. Instead, I'm going to invite you to take a couple minutes right now to turn to one or two other people near you and talk about what you think is the most important environmental challenge that confronts us today. And if you're a strong introvert, you can just contemplate on your own. Turn to one or two people. What's the most important environmental challenge? Let me hear a couple of them. Just the issue. Just shout it out, and I'll repeat it in the microphone so everyone can hear. Carbon dioxide.
Impending water shortages.
Humility. Plastics. Humility.
Bees.
What was it?
Environmental apathy.
Do you feel that burden? Really feel it? Hold it for a moment. Take it into your body. Feel it press on your shoulders. Climate change, plastic proliferation, overpopulation, water crises, species extermination, apathy. All of this weighing us down. Now take a breath. Take a deep breath. Breathe together. Feel and know that this earth is supporting your life. And it's tugging at you to support its life. I remember the first Earth Day. It was 1970. I was in high school. Not long after that first Earth Day, I joined a new club at my school, the Ecology Club. Ecology was a flashy new name. We collected aluminum cans and tried to educate people. And that's what we've been doing for 48 years, collecting aluminum cans and trying to educate. Of course, that's not entirely fair. The environmental movement has had impact, but the effects have been limited because the problems are so big, so tied to the way we live and so resistant to solutions that might fit in with our expectations, especially in this capitalist, ever-growing economy and society. So this year's theme for Earth Day is ending plastic pollution, especially in our oceans. Is there anyone here who doesn't use plastics? I didn't think so. So, we are all contributing to the plastic mess. And the thrust for Earth Day is to get individuals to decrease how much plastic they use. And that's fine and maybe even admirable. You can find YouTube stories and TED Talks about how individuals have reduced or even eliminated their use of plastics. And you may have heard of the 30-minute film Straws. Has anybody heard of the film Straws? Okay. It documents the pervasivity and harmfulness of plastic straws, a convenience that was invented in relatively recent history in the scale of things, and this campaign to end the use of plastic straws as something that is entirely unnecessary and surprisingly destructive. Getting rid of straws, though, is not so easy. More than 500 million a day are used in the U.S. alone. Yet no one using one straw will think that much about it. It's so petty. And that shows us the reason we struggle so much around these issues of environmentalism. We keep trying to make individual solutions to what is a collective problem. A problem that doesn't belong to you or me or someone over there. It's a problem that belongs to all of us together, and that all of us contribute a little bit, but so little that how can you blame me? Or even expect me to change my behavior? Because after all, if I do change and no one else does, then my change was pointless, right? And there are a few people who live entirely off the grid, and their existence does little to impact the worsening of the myriad of problems that we cataloged earlier. I heard someone this week on the radio explain that behavioral norms have a larger impact on what we do than our beliefs do. Now take that in. Behavioral norms have a larger impact on what we do than our beliefs do. Now that is a challenge to us UUs who are so committed to our carefully calculated belief systems. We've worked hard to figure out what we think. Are we likely to set that aside because the expectations for our behavior, the norms of our culture, differ from our beliefs? Yes, we are. Not because of any terrible thing about us personally, or because of any abstract theory like original sin, simply because we are human. Despite the individualism that came along with the Industrial Revolution, we remain herd animals. So norms are pretty strong things for us to resist. Few of us want to find ourselves far outside the acceptable norms. As human beings, when the crunch comes and we have to either change our behavior or ignore our beliefs in these situations, the tendency is to ignore our beliefs. Or as Groucho Marx said, "Those are my principles, and if you don't like them, well, I have others." So, when you're sitting at the restaurant where everyone expects to be served a drink with a straw, even though the drink is in a real glass that you can drink out of, and the habit of the server is to bring a straw for everyone, the norms are established, and few of us think to say, "No straw, please." It draws attention to us, and what does my insignificant straw mean out of the 500 million that will be thrown out today? See? That's the problem we face with trying to change just one of the thousands of little behaviors that need to address, to change even the one problem of plastic proliferation, much less climate change, desertification, fracking, oil pipelines, coal-fired electrical plants, reliance on fossil fuels, and so on and on and on. Now, when environmental issues first came to our attention, we needed stark language, because we had never thought of it that way. Rachel Carson described DDT and similar chemicals as elixirs of death. And it got people's attention, and DDT was banned. Now, though, we've been listening to those apocalyptic threats too long to even hear them anymore. New films by Al Gore or new books on extinction don't have the impact that Carson's The Silent Spring had. We can't keep doing environmental activism the same way and expect anything to change. The Christian feminist theologian Sally McFaig writes, given our twin planetary crises of climate change and unjust financial distribution, what is needed is not more information, but the will to move from belief to action, from denial to profound change at both personal and public levels. The religions of the world, countercultural in their assumption that to find one's life, one must lose it, are key players in understanding and promoting a movement from a model of God, the world, and the self focused on individualistic, market-oriented accumulation by a few, to a model that sees self and planetary flourishing as interdependent. We live within our models and make decisions on the basis of them. The interdependent model demands self-emptying or great compassion on the part of the well-to-do so that all human beings and other life forms may live just, sustainable lives. So McFaig suggests that what we need is the will to move from belief to action. We have to conquer that tendency to ignore our beliefs when they come up against the norms we live with. We don't need more information. There's plenty of information already there. You've seen the stories and read the statistics. The case has been clearly made over and over and over. The people who need to hear those facts have covered their ears, and more information will not change anything. McFaig contends that we currently have a belief structure, a model that is based on the self, the world, and even God privileging an individualistic orientation. You see that in people talking about the need for individual salvation. And as the reading said this morning, we don't need individual salvation. That's not what we need. This individual orientation allows us to think that we can end proliferation of plastic by convincing individuals to stop using straws, or eating vegan more often, or paying more attention to their carbon footprint. Instead, we need a model, a belief structure that turns individualism on its head and recognizes interdependence. We can't do it alone. I did volunteer work for many years in a lesbian community with a supervisor who used to say, one dyke can't do anything. Two dykes can do anything. And alone, isolated, we question ourselves. If we approach something together, we create a new paradigm. It's not my problem, it's our problem. We support one another, we encourage one another, we go from being unable to do anything to being able to do anything. And we UUs have the model of interdependence that Sally McFaig was talking about. We call it the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We also call it our seventh principle. And what does that belief structure require? It requires letting go of our individual selves, losing our lives to save them, letting go of our individual selves in order to participate in and protect this larger interdependent web. This helps us to identify with something larger in a more profound way than simply adhering to group norms. Instead of being part of the group of human beings, we become part of the universe. Instead of being a member of humanity, we become a member of the cosmos. This isn't just a pretty picture of interconnection, but a model for our living and a simple, concrete fact. As science writer Rachel Carson said way back when, the home of wildlife is also our home. So what changes in our thinking if we quit the reductionist, breaking things into parts way of thinking that came with the model of the universe as clock based in the Industrial Revolution. Deep ecologist Joanna Macy describes the properties of life's self-organization. And this is taking that interdependent web seriously and learning to describe it. So she lists four different properties. First, Macy tells us that each system, from atom to galaxy, is a whole. A whole, W-H-O-L-E. It's whole. It's quite literally more than the sum of its parts. Who could guess that combining oxygen and hydrogen would make a substance characterized by wetness? Who could guess that? Second, systems self-regulate even as circumstances around them change. These systems use matter, energy, and feedback systems to continually strive for balance. That way, we keep our body temperature fairly constant, unless there's something really disturbing, like an infection. Ecosystems maintain their rich diversity in animal life, constantly rebalancing predators and prey. So these systems self-regulate. Third, these systems, even as they balance and rebalance, evolve. They evolve in complexity, and they can change if they need to in response to changes around them. They can even fall apart and reorganize. Finally, every system is a holon, H-O-L-O-N. You know that word, holon. That is, every system is itself part of a bigger system, and it's a whole by itself, and it contains within it other subsystems. So all of these things are simultaneously true, and this is an inadequate way of really describing how the interdependent web works, but what we've got going on is all of these systems, not different parts, but systems that always are working together, interacting with other systems. Given this complexity, we can begin to see how introducing something into a system, say DDT or plastics, ends up having effects that are completely unpredictable as these systems jostle around and potentially devastating. And somehow we humans seem to like to keep upsetting the apple cart with these new introductions. We are continually testing this precious interdependent web to see if it will hold. Sometimes I wonder if global climate change might simply be Gaia's way to shake off this human infection she seems to have acquired. She'll be fine, somehow, sooner or later, balancing and rebalancing. It's us we have to worry about. Knowing what we know about the Earth, we're not going to solve the problems before us by doing the same things we've been doing the last 50 years. Macy and other deep ecologists contend that we cannot accept old models placing narrow human concerns as central and keeping humans in some sort of controlling role over the Earth. That's not how the Earth works. In 2008, after Barack Obama won the nomination for president, he said, "I am absolutely certain that generations from now we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal." Now that's what the Greeks call hubris. I don't think that's going to happen. The ocean is still rising at an increasing rate, about an eighth of an inch a year, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The planet's healing has a long way to go. And while some of us are clamoring for change in the larger world and making our individual commitments of using the right light bulbs and buying fuel-efficient cars, many of our political and business leaders insist that the economy must never suffer for any environmental good. To make the necessary changes, we're going to need to look somewhere else for our inspiration. Not to the scientists who keep giving us facts, not to the political and business leaders who are too worried about the wrong things to make the right choices. Perhaps not to the dominant culture at all. Oh, I'll take out that perhaps. Not to the dominant culture at all. We need to look to the margins to see what is emerging. To people and other beings who are most affected by the continued devastation of our planet. And here's some of what I see on the margins. Gloria Flora is on the margins, a woman who spent 23 years in the strongly male-dominated U.S. Forest Service. In 1997, as forest supervisor of the Lewis and Clark National Forest in north central Montana, she decided not to allow oil and gas leases. There were plenty of studies in preparation for the decision, ecological studies, public and private meetings, plenty of information. Flora, though, made the decision, she says, intuitively. Her justification? These are her words. It was far too important ecologically and culturally to risk developing for short-term gain. One motivating factor was the profound ecological and historical significance of that landscape. The second was the people's attachment to the place. People's love of that landscape and their profound connection resonated on a heart level. There was no way I could allow it to be damaged. Flora based her decision on valuing the land and the connection of the people and the plants and the animals to that land, recognizing the interdependent web and its worth in and of itself. Not because of what it could produce or be made into. That's a decision coming from the margins. You've probably never heard of Gloria Flora. You may have heard, though, of Wangari Maathai, the founder of the Green Belt Movement in Kenya, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. And though she was recognized this way before her death in 2011, most of her life, too, was on the margins. You may not know that she studied here in Kansas at what's now the Benedictine College in Atkinson under a Kennedy scholarship for her bachelor's degree. She went on to study, of course, many other places. But a biologist, what she's known for is planting trees and encouraging others to plant trees despite political and social struggles in her country as she did all of this. And she stressed, in her own words, the importance of communities taking responsibility for their actions and mobilizing to address their local needs. We all need to work hard to make a difference in our neighborhoods, regions, and countries, and in the world as a whole. That means making sure we work hard, collaborate with each other, and make ourselves better agents of change. So she's seeing connections then between human creation, human community, and the creation of an improved planet, just as Gloria Flora did. In Kenya, she changed the norm of human behavior so that planting trees became part of the norm, so that people could live according to new models and understandings. Paul Hawken, a longtime environmentalist and writer, has stumbled onto what he says is a surprising phenomenon. We might call it an emergent phenomenon. People all over the world, of all races and religions, are working to make things right. Here's what he sees. Coherent, organic, self-organized congregations involving tens of millions of people dedicated to change. If you look at the science that describes what is happening on Earth today and aren't pessimistic, you don't have the correct data. If you meet people in this unnamed movement and aren't optimistic, you haven't got a heart. What I see are ordinary and not so ordinary individuals willing to confront despair, power, and incalculable odds in an attempt to restore some semblance of grace, justice, and beauty to this world. So Hawkins characterized it as the largest movement in the world, unlike any other movement we have ever seen, because it has no leader, or it has a tremendous number of leaders, and it has no name. It's not organized in any conventional way. Rather, it's organic, springing up in specific local places and yet connecting in unexpected ways with one another. Its ideology continually reshaping itself, its tactics continually reshaping themselves. And prominent in it is indigenous culture and the resistance of that culture to globalization, or at least to globalization of the business type. Unlike conventional organizations, this movement can't be divided and conquered by the opposition because it's not united in the first place, but can form and reform as needed. It considers human rights and the good of the planet as interlocking connected issues. And this movement includes Cree people fighting waste sites in northern Alberta. It includes Shi Li Hong and her husband, Chinese documentarians who make films about migrants being displaced by dams. It includes Sumita Dasgupta, who leads 10-day treks in Gujarat, India, to explore ancient rainwater harvesting to fight drought. And it includes countless other people. And it sounds to me like the movement that Hawkins talks about shares many of the characteristics that Joanna Macy writes about as life's self-organization, whole and complete themselves with other systems in them, and they themselves part of bigger systems, balancing and rebalancing themselves. Holons able to adapt to the environmental changes by splitting apart, reforming and doing what is necessary. They act more like organism than organization. This is what is emerging. And this is what many of us are part of already. And we keep becoming more and more a part of that. And this is the direction that we have to move to bring changes, to act less as organizations and more as organisms, working with one another and with the earth itself. Ra Goddess, a young black performance artist, activist, and social entrepreneur, says that the universe itself will work with us as we work. Now, that's an astounding idea that only makes sense if we really believe that interdependent web stuff that we've been telling ourselves for years. Somehow, the earth, the web, will work with us in the work. And what the existence of this movement tells us is that we are not alone. Remember, one of us can't do anything. Two of us can do anything. The changes in approach that this requires are both subtle and complex. Instead of citing statistics, we need to tell stories. We need to fortify ourselves with spiritual energy, connecting with one another and with the animals and the plants and the water and the land itself in what may be unexpected ways. We need to listen. We need to listen especially to those most profoundly affected. And we need to listen to indigenous voices that retain close connections with the land. We need to ground ourselves in particular local places, knowing them, and making our issues and our engagement based on the place where we are, while at the same time connecting with people all over the world doing similar work so that we also support their work. And we saw this in the water defenders in their work, where indigenous tribes all over the world were connecting with them. We need to see the connections among all our issues, way beyond just the environmental concerns. And we need to pay attention to the margins and to those most affected, the people in Flint whose water still isn't right, the people of Kiribati whose Pacific islands are drowning, the multiple species of animals disappearing, the farmers suffering drought and weather extremes due to climate change. I'm sure you can think of many others. To leave you with hope, I conclude with words from Hra Goddess, the performance artist I mentioned earlier. As next wave women, we commit to self-determination. And working across culture, race, and class as a deliberate testimony to the power of collaboration among the underserved and the underengaged. And you would be surprised to find who fits underneath those headings. This is not like rescuing, but more like universal sisterhood. We could say universal sisterhood, brotherhood, siblinghood, universal family. In the making. Yes, we got issues and we got lots to do, and Goddess knows I get tired just thinking about it, but I trust in a very deep place that as we fortify our souls and spirit, the universe will line up beside us and we will be given everything we need to go the distance. After all, what we are calling the state of our world is simply a reflection and a projection of our internal afflictions being played out on the global stage. We have to understand this, and we have to dedicate ourselves to sustainability, and we have to hold our centers like we hold each other. Together, we hold the planet, rocking the world back into balance, humbly, sacredly. One soul, one voice, one woman, and I'll add one man, one person at a time. So may it be. Our closing hymn is one of our favorites, I think. It's number 1064 from the teal book, Blue Boat Home. I invite you to rise in body and or spirit.
Thank you.
And so this morning we dedicate ourselves to sustainability and we hold our centers like we hold each other. Together we hold the planet, rocking the world back into balance, humbly and sacredly, one soul, one voice, one person at a time, together, united. Amen.